Welcome back to the BIM Hero podcast. In this episode, we'll be talking about GIS, we'll be talking about underground utilities and the science of wear. Welcome, gentlemen. Just wanted to start out by introducing yourselves.
Go ahead, John.
All right. So my name's Jonathan Ng. I'm the Global Sales Director for Hexagon. And basically, I cover the whole coverage of all our different buildings and infrastructure products.
And I'm Chris Jackson from Esri. I'm part of the Global Business Development team, based out of London, but looking at all of our distribution companies in Europe.
So one of the things that I wanted to start off with that I think is really fascinating about what you two do is I think for a long period of time in this industry, we always concentrated on the actual coordination of the building. But we had no idea, I guess, in terms of trying to get involved with the actual environment that it was going to be built in. How did the concept of both of your companies come about in that trying to fill that need?
I'm happy to start. I'm the son of an architect. And so I spent a long time when I was a kid next to him with his drawing board, sheet of paper, drawing buildings, imagining places, but we never put a map underneath it. You know, it was 00. And so the idea of using context right at the outset, it's sort of been there. You know, the concept of landscape design and urban design is not new at all. But the idea of having an accurate starting point, you know, proper latitude, longitude, or an actual location to start your drawing from, hasn't really taken off until, you know, recent times. Our business has been primarily in the government space, supporting landowners, agricultural practices, anything that's happening in the natural environment, forestry. That's Esri's an acronym, actually, for the Environmental Systems Research Institute. And the earliest work that was conducted late in the 1960s was about mapping agricultural land and floodplains and asking questions about what if and how, you know, trying to understand the relationship of information to maps. So we have a strong history of working in those industries, in the government space. And then latterly, we've discovered this sort of new requirement to integrate, and there's a convergence going on between GIS technology and BIM technology. So we're really excited about it because there's so much opportunity. And we sort of paraphrase it as designing with context. Mm-hmm. Because the GIS, the strength of a GIS, the strength of thinking geographically is that you are taking account of the natural environment and the societal environment, you know, the way that humans move around both the urban and the natural environments. So it's too easy to say, well, why would you not do that as an architect or an urban planner, or if you're involved in master planning? It's too easy to say, well, why wouldn't you do that? And of course, people have been doing this. But the opportunity now is because the technology integrations are so much easier to accelerate that. And by accelerating that, our goal is to accelerate the design process, the speed to insight, helping people to create more sustainable designs, helping to improve collaboration between all of the various stakeholders, because, you know, architects, engineers, construction professionals, owners, everyone knows how to use a map.
Right.
This is what we come back to, is the glue that sort of underpins everything in that context.
Yeah, so. And take that map of what they've known and put that in a common environment that they understand with buildings.
Yeah.
And now trying to make the connections.
Exactly right. Yeah. And the cause and effect, you know. So what happens if we change the angle of the building? You know, how does the natural sunlight affect its CO2 properties?
Correct.
Right? So how do we help with carbon counting of material choice by adjusting the building orientation because of the azimuth of the sun in spring, right? Or the type of the tree canopy that might be close by because of the species of tree, and all of these interconnections that we experience in our own lives, but that haven't been that easy to do in technological terms.
And then from the perspective of Hexagon, what are you trying to do on your front software base and yeah. hardware base.
Yeah. So I think Hexagon has a similar history where we wanted all these mapping, and we have all these various technologies for scanning to map, and even we have planes that do all these mapping across the world. But ultimately, at Hexagon, we see that data is the new oil, right? This is where content is actually very important. And that's where our geospatial content systems, right? We are providing these data to everybody, whether it's companies that needs logistics planning, that they need to know what's the environment, where they're working in, and then they can construct effectively. So I think from Hexagon's point of view, our content business is going to be the future. It's going to move into data rather than actually physical equipment and things like that.
And on that front, do you see that the data that you're extracting, whether it's on the surface or if it's under the surface, does the advantages seem vast? And then on that note from both of you, how can we improve data collection of under the ground? I think that's the next big push of this. We can see it, but what can we not see?
Correct. And that's the limitations, right, of the current technology. Whether it's the Amazon forest that we are trying to map right now, you've got different levels of canopy. We can't see really what's on the ground itself. And that's where we really need to improve some of our scanning and mapping technologies so that we can do this. And these are exercises that we are doing, that we are mapping the Caribbean, right, for seagrass, because we want to test how can we improve our technologies to really look through these canopies and get to the bottom of the sea, literally.
What do you think on that?
Well, I completely agree. And I'd also say it's the same above ground.
Right.
You know, increasingly we see construction projects, as an example, using more and more sensors to monitor and to track and measure nitrogen dioxide on site, sulfur dioxide, you know, particulate matter. You know, we can ingest weather sensor data to track how the concrete offsetting is going to, you know, be impacted. There's some amazing work being done by a startup to look at CO2 emissions using the NASA low orbit satellite system. So, you know, the incredible thing is that it's always exciting.
Yeah.
Our industry, the geospatial.
It is.
I hope Jonathan agrees with it. I find myself finding this saying this every year. It's never been more exciting to be involved in the geospatial industry because. The technology moves along, of course it does, but it's what we can do, it's what our customers are doing with it, which is really exciting, you know, and helping them to change the way they think about things, you know, helping us to move from, again, in the construction space, since we're at the BIM Coordinator Summit, helping us to shift minds from the linear, the old sort of traditional linear approach to infrastructure development through to thinking about more circular principles, you know. You can't do that unless you take the time to understand the interconnectedness and the complexity of the natural and the built environment and how they interact. I think the other thing that really strikes me is that for the last 200 years, we've had a mindset which is that humanity and development is in control of nature.
Right.
You know, so we've just taken what we needed and we throw a third of it away. And, We really haven't cared, right? So my hope is that through helping people to understand that design in context, we can change that mindset so that we have infrastructure designs that are subservient to nature,
right?
Or at least recognize that nature is actually, you know, we are part of nature. We're not above it, and you know, we've got to recognize that because
right.
we need to make that change in the way we think about the land that we have.
Right, because you have a, we've always looked at it as a static building. And really it is static buildings in an ecosystem of buildings, in an ecosystem of the living world. And I don't think we have, as a society, especially in the AEC industry, respected that the right way, but also in the right world of planning that in that way. We're in a dynamic world where all of these things that you guys are focused in on have a huge impact on a project, cost-wise, how long it's going to take to do it.
Yeah.
And I think it's really exciting where that's going. And
yeah.
Just the question I have is, what are some of the different products that you guys have that you feel like are just absolute game changers that are going to change geospatial space?
wow, we've got lots of products.
Yeah,
I can go on my sales pitch right now. But really, I think it's like you said, right? I'm originally from Singapore, where we have this living building in Singapore where we really mix both nature and any buildings. And I think that's the key, is that there needs to be that mindset change from the architects, the owners, to really do this. And ultimately, everything that Hexagon produce is supporting this. We are not going to be the ones that are going to change the designs, but how can we support these processes to be more effective? And ultimately, I just presented at the connected platform, it is connecting the information. And that's where we have different technologies to connect everything. And metaverse, right? That's really where we can bring everything together, connect all these data, and then you are able to use it in an effective way.
Yeah. And I think that's the next step, is taking the data that's in your platforms, being able to either merge that into an authoring software, or, you know, produce a situation where you can export the data and put it in more effectively.
So there's two things to me. There's the data collection.
Correct.
Right? So Esri has a curated set of content under what we call the Living Atlas. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that is global data sets. Yep. that we curate. But a huge number of the layers within that Living Atlas are actually provided by our customers.
Right.
You know, so our role is to help them to be able to collect more data that is meaningful to their work, you know, not just collecting it for collecting its sake, but is to be able to help them to collect it more efficiently, and then to be able to make faster decisions or get faster insight from using the analytical tools to, you know, analyze the data, overlay it with other content and so on. So I would say so you talk about new products. I mean, these will be common for both of our companies. You know, the area of reality mapping.
Yes.
Using drones, using low-flying aircraft, even satellite imagery, to rapidly collect massive amounts of data, process it really quickly, and then be able to use it for so many different purposes, you know. And the idea there is really to help that decision-making process. It's
right.
Revealing patterns. It's revealing things that you wouldn't otherwise see. So I think in that space, the reality mapping space, there's a huge amount. Well, reality mapping meaning not just the concept of the imagery, but the tools that you can now use to capture it and then process it. And the other one, inevitably, you've probably heard this word in here, mm-hmm. Corey, many times today,
you know,
is AI.
Of course.
Right? Oh, I was going to say that one.
Oh, sorry.
The analytics behind all this work.
It's like, so if I could ask, too easy to go to ChatGPT and say, please give me the design for a building that respects environmental stewardship, social equity, and economic resilience, and it needs to house these, you know, this number of people and this residential commercial mix. And by the way, this is where it is.
Yeah.
Right? Why not? At least have some design options. We're seeing this already. Some architecture firms are doing very, very fast iterative design and optioneering, you know, using AI.
Yeah.
So that is definitely coming.
And I think the industry as a whole, on the construction side, anything that deals with the earth, moving of dirt, having to deal with geotechnical aspects of it is big cost.
Right.
And being able to plan for that is very important.
And it's not just economic cost either.
Right.
I'll give you an example. Balfour Beatty Vinci, they're a joint venture in the UK that are working on the High Speed 2 rail infrastructure project.
Right.
They're using Mavic drones.
Yep.
And they are doing stockpile volumetrics.
Yep.
Okay. So they've estimated that across the piece of work that they're doing, they could be saving up to £5 million easily, you know.
Yeah, the dirt's not cheap. It's not cheap. You're handling it again, you're moving it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the thing that I like about that story is that it's actually the benefits are not just financial. Mm-hmm. You know, this is always almost like a proper sustainability story.
Because right.
Not only is it saving them money and making them economically more viable as a delivery agent, but guess what? You know, they don't have teams of staff going out with ranging poles, climbing up 10-meter high stockpiles, putting themselves at risk, you know, in weather conditions that are often, you know, unpredictable.
Just to see how much dirt is in the pile.
To do the same work, right? So they can now scan a stockpile in about 20 minutes, create the 3D model,
work out proper the control, and still within how accurate?
Centimeter accuracy. Yeah, yeah. You know, I mean, and be able to determine when do we need the next delivery,
right,
to fill it back up. Mm-hmm. Is it being used at the speed we thought that it was?
Right.
What can we learn about how the project is going by doing this piece of analysis? So they're helping to improve health and safety on site. They're saving money.
Yep. They're by not moving the dirt.
They're saving time because they can make decisions faster. And they're lowering their carbon footprint,
yep,
because they've got fewer people involved in the overall process, you know. So it's that sort of mindset from construction companies like Balfour Beatty Vinci that are driving us, because we see those, you know, questions coming, and we our product roadmap is very much geared towards customer requirements. Mm-hmm. You know, that's part of our DNA, is that's always been the way that we've developed products. So when you get innovative companies like that saying, no, we want to do things differently, we think we know, we've got some ideas, but we, you know, and then we can get to work.
Yeah, I think that's something that's really interesting. We talked the other day was about what you guys are doing with a product like AgTech, and you're taking something that is I've said this multiple times today, but it's not a sexy thing, but it has a lot of it's got a lot of costs associated with it, and you make it easier to understand and break down, so that when you go to the reporting of it, you understand what you're moving in a very quick amount of time. But also, I think that what gets lost is the ability to take that into the coordination and not just use the 2D data that you're getting from it, but also the 3D information.
Yeah, I agree. I think a lot of our AgTech customers are really doing all these dirt calculations, the volumetric, but it's not used to the fullest extent.
Correct.
Right? We can include and pass this to a GPS model, pass it to a machine control, and continue the process. Mm. And that's where a lot of our customers tend to just stop at the dirt simple parts.
Mm-hmm.
You don't go all the way, yeah, right? So it's really about connecting it. And in the end, it's efficiency, right? And the carbon footprint. And in the end, we believe machinery should be autonomous, right? Why can we do it in manufacturing, mm-hmm, that basically everything is autonomous? There's one operator for a whole factory. But look at our job sites. We have hundreds of people.
Mm-hmm. So, and they're all put at risk when they're in those types of environments.
Exactly right. And you come back to buried assets. We're talking about underground,
yeah,
data. So we're every day on a construction site, there is the risk that a construction worker, if they're involved in digging into the ground, might come across some buried asset that was inaccurately mapped or whatever. So,
and what if it's like power?
Sure.
It could be a major consequence.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So these are the interesting bits when we get to even still in the traditional construction method, you know, we can start to use AR and VR. You know, I've seen great demonstrations from a company called VLabs and a construction firm, Hymans, in the Netherlands, where they're using similar Oculus Rift headsets to actually visualize the buried assets and make sure that before they go anywhere near anything, that they know exactly where everything is. You know, that's you can't do that in many other technologies than geospatial technology. You know, that's what's exciting.
The other piece of this too is, and we'll come back to the utilities in another part of the conversation, but it's also the soils. I mean, able to look at like unsuitable soils versus rock versus, I feel like that's a geotechnical piece that is something that a lot of people have not been exposed to, whether they didn't go to university to study it, or have not come in contact, or it's a complex topic to really dive into and, mm-hmm, understand the processes of how the data is collected, how it comes out.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think that's a huge part when a project gets started and you do borings on a project and you're trying to understand what that job is trying to do. Mm-hmm. You know, the logical sense at this point is more borings. You just keep boring, because the idea is like, how do I know from this boring to that boring that the earth stayed the same? Because, mm-hmm, the earth is constantly changing. Mm-hmm. I'm just curious, where do you feel that aspect of the geospatial world is going to go? Because we do as much as we can to create allowances to try to counteract some of that. Mm-hmm. But in the long run, there's only so much you could do with the data that you have.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Just interested in where you both think where that piece is going.
Well, here in the UK, we're really lucky to start with, because we have the British Geological Survey, who've, you know, they're not as old as the geology, but they've been around for a long time, okay? and the great thing there is that they've been doing 3D GIS for years to model the geology of Great Britain, you know? So that technology already exists, right? So interestingly for them, a commercial model might be to say, okay, well, all of a sudden there's a new application for our content now, because we can be providing this to construction firms to help them to design in context, as we said before. So we have this initial plan for a new bridge, let's say, or a new roadway. Well, actually, even though we think that that's the right orientation for it, are we checking against all the possible variables here? You know, going back to the sustainable, are we checking against the natural environment? Are we checking against the societal environment? You know, have we actually chosen the best position for this? And then even in it, further down, have we chosen the right position for the superstructure and the foundations?
Exactly.
So you're absolutely right. This is where that fusion of GIS and BIM is starting to add even more value now than just this the surface topography. Absolutely.
What do you think on that?
No, exactly. It's the same thing, right? We really need to know what we are working with, right? And that's the problem. It's really more balls, more tests to find out. And unfortunately, again, there is limited technology of really seeing what's underneath the ground.
And do you think that that hardware technology will develop over the next 15 years? Or that's the thing. I feel like the software is much further advanced and ready to obtain this information from the hardware, but the hardware hasn't caught up in this
regard. Yeah. I mean, I'm not an imagery or LiDAR or sonar expert at all.
But right.
Something that I found really interesting was that we have a product site scan, which is for doing drone survey, both setting out the flight path, but also then the collection of the data. And using machine learning models, we can identify things like cracks on runways, just as an example on an airport runway. So similar sort of outcomes to the stockpile example, where it's faster to survey, it's safer because you're doing it with a machine instead of human beings on the, you know, on the runway.
And a lot faster. Right?
It's faster, so you don't have to close down the runway for so long.
Exactly.
But the use of ground penetrating LiDAR and radar to be able to measure the depth of the cracks from a distance is then where it gets really interesting.
Because
you can then start to say, right, well, we only need to do the maintenance schedule on these and not everything. Think of the time that saves. It's astonishing, really.
Yeah.
So I expect to see more of that, you know, ground penetrating application.
Deeper, and how far we can go.
Yeah, because why not?
Yeah, exactly. But it comes down to a health and safety thing. Mm-hmm. There might be a technology that's out there that might be able to take on the challenge, but does it change the characteristics of the Earth to try to collect the data?
Right.
That's something we don't want to go down.
Sure.
You know, so it's a catch 22 on that. Mm-hmm. I get a lot of questions throughout the year about what is geospace spatial data trying to do, and where is geotechnical engineering going, and how we solve, you know, retaining walls and different structures and try to figure out that.
Yeah.
It's such a unsettled science because there's just so much still unknown about.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you could start to think about things like geothermal energy for heating and lighting and heating and cooling of buildings again, in that sustainable mindset of thinking, okay, well, now we have the capability through boring and tunneling, but, you know, in the same way, we should be able to develop technologies to do that faster and more efficiently.
Correct.
And more accurately to say, okay, well, now when we're designing this neighborhood, we know that if we were to actually just move it, not only does that perhaps have a lower environmental impact because we're further away from the protected species, but actually that area is a much better source of geothermal energy. So, you know, again, designing in context, I think, is the thing that excites me about this.
You know, going to the utilities again, I think the fascinating thing about utilities versus like the unsuitable soils is that it is typically something that stays consistent. There's times that it doesn't, but for the most part, there is. And I think that as we progress with, you know, coordination of different items, it's taking the time up front at the beginning of a project and effectively capturing the existing condition, whether that is in the ground, like we've talked about, or if it's in the air, just doing the land. I feel like that has to become an essential piece of coordination moving forward. Mm-hmm.
I fully agree. I think the biggest problem is that every time a contractor gets awarded, they rush to sign.
Right.
Well, that's the
but only... if we took a couple extra, just a little bit extra time to do some research about the existing condition, the amount of time and money saved would be astronomical.
Exactly. And that's the biggest issue, right? It's the minute they get that award, they rush to site, they take over, and they start doing.
Yeah.
And that's where we really need to plan more before doing, right? And doing that few more days, or it really makes a big difference. And somehow we need to change that mindset. If we don't, all the contractors are still going to do the same way, rush the site, let's start building.
Yep. And some of that is driven by the client, right? Because the client wants to take and get something that they can then turn into a cash flow, right? That's the idea, right? For most structures, unless it's, you know, governmental and it's probably got some use cases to help society, you know, hospitals and governmental buildings. But I think that that's one of the things is that as soon as a client actually, you know, that they're gonna start building this project on that property, they should absolutely start the process of reviewing the world that it's gonna sit on.
Yeah,
they shouldn't wait for that design to continue.
And you're right that it starts with the client.
Yeah,
you know, we've had a lot of discussions this morning in the planning stage about client requirements driving contractor behavior, right? Because, you know, it's sad to say, but it's true that the majority of general contractors are working to, you know, low margin, high risk. So they've got to manage cash flow and they've got to make sure that they're delivering, you know, as efficiently as they can. And my general observation is that that drives them more towards an economic way of thinking than a sustainable way of thinking. So in that example, if we're looking at an infrastructure owner who's saying, or a utility owner that's saying, right, well, I need a new piece of infrastructure. And if the owner is thinking sustainably with respect to environmental stewardship and making sure that the services that they're going to be providing are socially equitable and, yes, of course, being economically and, you know, resilient and so on. But if they're driving that into the requirements, then that will in itself help the GC, the general contractors and the engineers and construction professionals to think differently themselves. Mm-hmm. The only other way that it can work is, of course, if you have a company, an AEC, an engineering firm or a construction firm that wants to take that sustainable approach from the outset and actually challenge the requirements that they've been given.
Yeah.
Right. So it could be that it works from either direction. But what I think is that we need a lot more of that mindset shift, you know, and it's got to happen fast. Exactly. Yeah.
What's your thoughts on that?
I think, on top of what was said, right, I think it's also the contracting model.
Yeah.
The owner is passing the risk to the general contractor, the general contractor to the subs, and everybody is just passing the risk.
Yeah.
And that's fundamentally the problem, right? If we work together, then all these risks is all shared. We, of course, have all mitigation plans, but that's the problem. It's because no one's going to do more testing because it's his problem.
Mm-hmm. And it costs money.
And it costs money, so it's his problem. Yeah. And then it just keeps rolling.
Yeah.
So
They look back at you and they're saying, well, why didn't you tell me to do more testing? Well, we did tell you to do more testing.
But you couldn't afford it. Well, you said you didn't want it.
Exactly. And it's a controversial relationship off the bat.
Yeah.
Exactly. So I think that's one of the biggest issues is the contracting model. And if we can change that, if we can really work together, then all these risk transference will be lesser. It's not going to disappear, but at least a lot of these things could be actually solved upfront.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Clive Jordan from Planoly spoke about this morning.
Yeah.
He's a very good, I love Clive, he's a great
presenter. He'll actually be on here in about 2 hours.
Oh, well, okay. You ask him the same question.
I will.
He speaks very passionately about the ownership of the problem and, you know, the general mindset of it. Okay, some of it is human nature, you know, you're paid to do what you're paid to do, and then if you can get it off your plate, then you can get on with the next job. So it doesn't encourage that sense of ownership or commitment to the entire life cycle.
And sometimes they're still on the last project before they're doing two at the same time, and it's hard enough just to take on one.
Right. Yeah. So I agree with you, Jonathan. There's a need not only for better sense of commitment or a better sense of responsibility, but also a better sense of collaboration. You know, because it's too easy. We've seen it before, where information's passed from one stakeholder to the next, and then there's confusion, and then there's information gets lost, and there's rework required, and this is costly, and so on, and then you know you get into the who did, we did, whatever. You know.
So. Yeah, and just to conclude this session and this particular episode, I want to finish up with both of you on the topic of where GIS is going, where that is tying in with the cities, and how do we take a project-based approach to geospatial information and make it a smart city, more ecosystem-based mm-hmm. system?
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's a big one. So where we see it is that everything needs to come together. All the GIS, the BIM, the mesh, all these data needs to come together, and then we can plan better. Right. So again, I use Singapore as an example. We are mapping the half of Singapore and trying to capture everything and put all this information so that the planners can really see it and build in context. I think that's what Chris said is really important. And if you don't have that, you have that data gap and you're just building blindly, and that needs to change. So from our perspective, all these capturing needs to be done. Everything needs to be collated and connected.
And do you both think that there's an option from the architecture side or the design side that they would allow the data to be shared broadly? Because I think, you know, earlier today, I felt like that was going to be a big challenge, because that's some of the architectural, creativity. Mm-hmm. But if we're ever going to get to a point where we're trying to understand how all the buildings and bridges and everything of infrastructure impacts our world, it's going to have to be much more collaborative.
Yeah, I completely agree. And this is where we get into, again, the real value proposition of GIS generically, is that it's that common framework. You know, it enables us not only to just integrate different data sets, but I'm going to say the other word, it's the digital twin world. You know, we can...
It's come up a lot today.
We can, I'm sure, yeah, it's
bad. AI and digital there twin are go. The top two. Yeah,
buzzword bingo. what that location framework gives you is the means to connect digital twins together, right? So are we ever going to get to an entirely complete metaverse of the world? Well, you know, maybe one day. Why not? Let's just say
that's
why
the goal,
not, right? Yeah. Let's say why not. Until then, though, what we can do now, what people are already doing today, is connecting together digital twins to give more of a holistic view of yes. an asset or piece of infrastructure or a city. So
because we Singapore can't get to the point we can't get to the point where 60 years from now we still have data that's not connected and like paper that nobody knows if it's right or the as-built or all over the place. Yeah. I mean,
and we can handle the ownership part, you know, we can handle the storage part, mm-hmm. you know, we can make sure that we've got checks and balances in place so that people's IP is protected in that way. But unless people are prepared to share their content under the right conditions,
of course, you know,
then we won't have that more holistic view. We won't understand the interconnectedness and the cause and effect and the consequence of our design or the expansion of our cities. We won't understand that in the depth that's required in order to help us to provide what has to be more resilient urban infrastructure.
And do you think that the cities kind of drive that change?
Yeah, they have to, because listen, urbanization is going up, right? Global population is slowing down, but it's not stopping.
Correct.
Right. At the same time, I was just chatting before at the Net Zero Lounge, which was great fun, by the way, about, you know, there's still desertification going on. There's still flood inundation going on. We will see more and more urbanization. So the only solution to that, when there's increasing population, is more urban infrastructure. But if we continue to design it and deliver it in the way that we've done historically, then we are not going to be able to have as lower impact in terms of climate change as we would like. You know, 1.5 degrees, most scientists are now saying, is just a folly. Mm. That's gone. So what does that leave us with? So it strikes me that the sooner that we can start to share that content and make better sustainable decisions about material choice, about, you know, circularity in the built environment, then the better chance we've got to provide resilient infrastructure for future generations.
Jonathan, final thoughts?
No, I'm quite bullish of where we are, especially with the computing powers, edge computing, quantum computing.
AI, all of them.
Yeah, I have to use AI and digital twin. But I really believe that we have reached that stage that we can do this. If you look back 10 years ago, we definitely did not have the computing power to put everything together. Mm. But now, I think we have reached that stage, whether it's NVIDIA's and things like that.
Yeah.
They are really, we have that powers. We can really put all of this together. Mm. And yeah, I'm quite bullish of having everything together and changing the way that we really build.
Yeah, completely agree. And I endorse your mentions of Singapore, because the digital twin of Singapore, you know, and it is incredible, isn't it? And just the mindset around the city planners and the way that they're thinking about the future is, and the thing is, we need to hold up, we need to shout about those examples. You know, that there are others, of course there are. It bothers me slightly though that we're not promoting them enough somehow outside of our own echo chamber, right?
Yeah.
We need for more people and more industries and
to buy into an industry that impacts everybody's life.
Exactly that, and have even citizens start to vote, you know, for these sorts of initiatives, so that, because they might not be aware that it's possible, as Jonathan said, because it is happening now. We just need more of it.
I want to thank you both for joining us. It's been a great episode. I think it's a fascinating topic that doesn't get a lot of coverage the way it should. And that was my goal for this today. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.